From KUT News and the Texas Tribune, this is The Ticket.
We demand our liberty.
You and I know that America deserves better.
Americans have come back from some pretty tough economic times.
But we need to fix it. We can't just talk about it.
And we are going to make our country great again.
I'm Ben Philpott.
And I'm Jay Root.
This week on the show, holy crap, we're less than a month away from the Iowa caucuses. And thanks to the journalism gods above, Texas reporters have been given GOP frontrunner Ted Cruz.
And frontrunner Cruz is going to provide much more to cover than bottom of the pack Rick Perry did in 2012. So today we're talking with Texas Tribune reporter Patrick Svitek, who's on the senator's Cruisin' to Caucus bus tour in Iowa.
And as we prepare for the most important night in American primary politics, we'll go over why Iowa gained its coveted election role in the first place. But first, Jay, it's our first show of 2016. We're racing towards Iowa and then New Hampshire and then bam, Super Tuesday. So what's the big story that you're going to be watching over the next couple of weeks?
Well, I still kind of think that a lot of these people that are so enthusiastic about Donald Trump have not proved themselves to be voters yet. I know that a lot of people are watching that as well, but that is the $64,000 question here. He's obviously captured a ton of media attention. Let's face it, we were really wrong about this, but we still haven't seen him prove that he knows how to organize people and get into the polls.
Right. I mean, I think now we kind of, the view is that Cruz certainly could win the Iowa caucus and Trump would come in second instead of first, as he's been, you know, pretty much since the moment he joined the race. But yeah, I think it would be really interesting to see. I mean, if those supporters don't come out, you could have a distant second Trump or a third place Trump. And then that really kind of, that may be enough to change what we assume is going to happen, or at least what the polls are telling us is going to happen in New Hampshire.
And if that does happen, if we do sort of have a Trump collapsing phenomenon and Ted Cruz does pick up a lot of those people, then we're going to look back on this. We're going to look back at the brilliant strategery, as it were, of Ted Cruz. I mean, this guy is a brilliant tactician. He has long said that after Barack Obama won in 2008, he studied the book on how he did it. He obviously looked at what Rick Santorum did in Iowa in 2012, and he's got somebody in all 99 counties in Iowa. You got to hand it to Ted Cruz. I mean, they've known all along that that they wanted to own the conservative, the far right, for lack of a better description, lane, and they've pretty much done it.
Actual voters casting actual votes. February 1st is so close, we can taste it. Now, we here at The Ticket have not made a habit of predicting the outcomes in these races. We've spent our time laying out all of the different candidates' pathways to victory instead of picking the winners.
But did we pick those pathways correctly? Did we make the right call? And what could win or lose the primary for a candidate? As we head toward caucus night, Ben and I thought it might be a good time to revisit what we said in a few of last year's Stump Interrupted segments.
Right. At the end of each Stump Interrupted, as you may remember, we played two sound bites, one showing why we thought a candidate would win the party nomination and the other why they'd lose.
First up, we'll start with the front runner in Iowa, Ted Cruz. Now, way back in April, we reviewed his presidential announcement speech, and here's why we said he'd win the nomination.
Instead of a government that works to undermine our Second Amendment rights, that seeks to ban our ammunition, imagine a federal government that protects the right to keep and bear arms of all law-abiding Americans. Instead of a government that seizes your emails and your cell phones Imagine a federal government that protected the privacy rights of every American.
Now, way back then, here's essentially what we said following up on that cut. You know, this is Ted Cruz's crowd. They are people that are suspicious of the federal government. They may think that President Obama is a criminal. They're afraid that their America is disappearing. And they love Ted because he represents the movement against this, against change, against difference, the hardcore Tea Partiers. And, you know, if the moderates all split up their votes, then he could have that shot at grabbing this demographic and winning the race. And I'm not sure that I feel too much differently from that now.
Well, we said then an outlier's chance of winning, and obviously it was more than an outlier's chance of getting in the lead. I mean, I think that we correctly predicted that he had that this was the lane that he was going to occupy, but that it was an outlier's chance. But, you know, really, again, I go back to his strategy. That what a great strategy to focus on the conservatives, to unify the conservatives, while Marco Rubio and Jeb Bush and Chris Christie and John Kasich and all these other sort of moderates are fighting over the establishment.
We all thought that he had one lane in the Republican Party and that maybe it was a 6 or 8 lane party. It seems pretty clear now that it definitely feels, when you look at the polls and stuff, much more like a 2-lane party. And one of those two lanes, the, you know, angry Republican lane, is a much wider lane than the establishment lane.
Right. And he and Donald Trump are in there dominating it. And one of them is going to fail. One of them is going to beat the other one at some point.
All right, now let's listen to our cut here of why we thought Ted Cruz would lose this race.
From the dawn of this country, at every stage, America has enjoyed God's providential blessing. Over and over again, when we faced impossible odds, the American people rose to the challenge. You know, compared to that, repealing Obamacare and abolishing the IRS ain't all that tough. The power of the American people when we rise up and stand for liberty knows no bounds.
What we said at the time about this was his, you know, grassroots army that was going to lead him to victory. You know, what, of course, happened when he tried to use this grassroots army previously in the U.S. Senate was that he was seen as a lone wolf out on the edge, and things like filibustering Obamacare, shutting down the government, did not make him popular at all.
Right. He's hated in Washington, let's face it. He called his boss, if you want to say that his boss is the Senate Majority Leader, a liar on the Senate floor. And so the guy is dead if he returns to the Senate and is not unsuccessful in this presidential race. Any agenda he would hope to have is dead. But I think, again, that we slightly underestimated this. I mean, I think we talked about this, but where we did underestimate it is that being hated in Washington is a badge of honor out there in this primary. And boy, Ted Cruz is wearing that badge proudly.
Now, we'll say, you know, we kind of ended it with saying that, you know, becoming a Tea Party hero is a great strategy for the primary, but a bad strategy for the general election. Clearly, it is a great strategy to win the primary. And I think the jury's still out on whether or not that's a good strategy for the election, general election.
I mean, obviously, again, as you said, we're not going to be predicting outcomes, but it's pretty clear that that Ted Cruz, if he wins the nomination, it will be because his strategy of consolidating the far right paid off and he won, you know, will have won the nomination. It's also true that being in the far right in a general election generally can be a big hurdle to winning, because you're not winning a primary, you're having to win in the hearts and minds of other people. So he will definitely have to pivot, and, you know, maybe he'll say, no, I really was for legalizing all those undocumented immigrants.
Well, you know, just real quickly on pivoting, we have seen this week that he is kind of walking back his anti-ethanol subsidies, which is something he essentially, the first time he went to Iowa, said, "Hi, how y'all doing? I am going to abolish your ethanol subsidies." And after getting hammered by a pack on that for a month or so, he's now said that he would phase them out instead of, you know, rip them up the moment he got into the White House. So maybe that's a little hint to how he may pivot in the general election. But, you know, so we've gone back. We've looked over what we said before. What do you see since April and maybe within the last couple of months? You know, what kind of themes do you see as being his defining moments now?
Well, you just put your finger on one of them, if I could take it in reverse, and that would be if we were to do another Stump Interrupted and talk about what could defeat him or why he would lose, it would be for the very reason that you just talked about with the ethanol subsidies. I mean, isn't that convenient? We're in Iowa, where there's no state that cares more about ethanol subsidies because they're making all the corn, and that's where ethanol comes from. And it's a big deal there. And it's one of those examples of where you can campaign all you want as a, quote, consistent conservative, but if you go into a state and that's what they really care about in that state and you see that as an impediment to winning, you might have to jettison some of your long-held principles, which the problem for Cruz on that is flip-flopping at all is bad, is potentially worse for Cruz than it is for other candidates, because other candidates are not out there saying, "I'm pure. Vote for me because I'm pure." And that really has been his message. And that could be his Achilles heel if he has one. If he's going to lose the primary, it's going to be because candidates like Marco Rubio in particular and others who have already started to attack Ted Cruz are saying, you know, you say you're such a consistent conservative. Well, you were for dramatically increasing legal immigration, visas for people to come here legally. You've jettisoned that. You said during in 2013 that you wanted a pathway not to citizenship but to legalization. He that was his position. That's been written about ad infinitum. He's backed off of that. Now we have another one, ethanol. So the whole consistent conservative thing has kind of fallen apart in the last few weeks. But I do think that he's proven himself to be a worthy presidential candidate.
Why Iowa? That's been my question since we started working on this podcast. Actually, it's been my question since I first started covering presidential campaigns. Why Iowa?
Iowa is where presidential candidates go for weeks, months on end. Iowans get to, no, they expect to not only hear every single candidate, they actually expect to shake hands with them. And then Iowa gets the first shot at voting. But why? Dennis Goldford is a political science professor at Drake University in Des Moines.
The parties, the national parties, sat down years ago and said, okay, we need to design a presidential nomination process, and it needs to meet criteria X, Y, and Z, and oh, guess what? Iowa fulfills those criteria better than any other state.
Oh, well, that was an easy answer. I guess we can move
wait,
on.
Wait. If only it were that easy.
That's not what happened.
Damn it.
It's a matter essentially of historical accidents. Put more facetiously, it's all Jimmy Carter's fault.
Actually, the events that led to Carter and the caucus, as we know it today, started during the run-up to the 1972 election, when, during the Democratic precinct caucuses, one of the major people there said, you know, while we're here, whom do you prefer to be our presidential nominee?
And lo and behold, while Ed Muskie, who had run unsuccessfully as Hubert Humphrey's vice presidential candidate in 1968, remained the leading candidate, Senator George McGovern of South Dakota popped up on the radar. And there was almost no media coverage, but those who were there paid attention to that, as did people around Governor Jimmy Carter down in Georgia. So when Carter left office in January of 1975, he essentially moved to Iowa and camped out here for the next 15 months. And then when the Iowa caucuses were held in March, I believe it was, of 1976, Carter actually finished second. Now, he finished second to undeclared or no preference but he finished ahead of all the other usual candidates people were talking about, like Senator Scoop Jackson from Washington State, among others. And, of course, as we know, Jimmy Carter went on to win the presidency, and so that put the Iowa gleam, if you will, in the eye of other future potential candidates.
Now, it could have just been a fluke. It could have just been a one-time thing that boosted one candidate. But
in 1980, George Bush, the first, decided to challenge Governor Reagan for the Republican nomination starting in Iowa, and Senator Ted Kennedy decided to challenge President Jimmy Carter for the Democratic nomination starting in Iowa. So that's what put the caucuses on more of a permanent footing, and the rest is history.
So that's how it started. Now let's focus on how it evolved and what the caucus means today. Kathy Obradovich is a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. She says when you look at the Republican side of the caucus aisle, you find all the different GOP factions represented, from Tea Party to so-called establishment Republicans to some libertarians. But it's one segment in particular that sets the tone.
So in Iowa, there is a very prominent and powerful religious conservative faction of the party, and they are looking for a candidate who best represents their issues. They're not necessarily looking for someone that they think is going to be the most likely to appeal to a general election audience. They think that that is a problem that the party has had in getting their candidates elected in November, is they've tried too hard to choose somebody who's a little bit too much like the Democratic candidate. So they didn't like Mitt Romney. They didn't like John McCain.
And with evangelicals leading the charge, she says there's one specific thing that can predict a top finisher on caucus night.
Well, one thing I'll be looking for is there a point at which the religious conservatives unify around one candidate? That happened very late in 2012, where individuals and religious conservative organizations suddenly rallied around Rick Santorum, and that really just shot him from nowhere. I mean, he had been lagging behind the polls for 2 years, and all of a sudden he shoots up and wins the Iowa caucuses.
But why Iowa? I hate to sound like a broken record here, but why do we need Iowa evangelicals and Iowa liberals to set the agenda for the entire presidential primary?
Well, Obradovich can answer some of that. She says the state plays a vital role in the nomination process.
It helps weed out some of these candidates who just can't go the distance. The second thing is you can't win it by having the most money. Somebody who doesn't have the most money or most fame can come out and be heard and actually potentially get on the national stage.
Candidates like the different evangelical-backed Republicans that have found success in Iowa. Oh, and Barack Obama. Sure, he was well known, but he wasn't expected to do much against Hillary Clinton. That is, until he won Iowa.
Now on the GOP side, breakout candidates backed by the state's strong evangelical bloc have not done as well through the rest of the primary season. Iowa was not an ultimately successful springboard for Rick Santorum or Mike Huckabee or Pat Robertson.
So, why Iowa? Did we answer the question? If not, don't worry. Jay and I will have lots more time there to find an answer.
You're listening to The Ticket. I'm Jay Root.
And I'm Ben Philpott. Nothing says Iowa caucuses like a bus tour. Jay and I both rode on the Perry for President bus tour in Iowa back in 2011. So far, neither one of us has joined the Ted Cruz cruising to caucus bus trip. So we're going to bring in the Texas Tribune's Patrick Svitek, who is on the road with Cruz right now. Patrick, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess why don't we just start with, how's the reception? What kind of reception is Cruz getting while he's out there?
Well, so far on the first day of this 6-day bus tour, he's been very well received. I mean, the events have been carefully planned. He's been packing every venue that he goes to. People spilling out the doors. People very excited to see him. I mean, this is kind of his first big trip to Iowa as a kind of definite front runner for the caucuses. The last time he was here, he was kind of emerging as a front runner. There were a few promising polls, but now that he's back in the state, he is definitely here as the kind of the favorite. It's certainly not a lock. I mean, he's not ahead in most polls by a wide margin over Donald Trump, but he is ahead And again, this is the first trip where he's kind of testing out life as a front runner in Iowa, all the perks that come with it, and then obviously all the newfound scrutiny that comes with it as well.
How important, Patrick, is the anybody but Cruz contingent? I mean, I've been reading a little bit about that, that there are sort of disaffected people that may have supported Huckabee or Santorum who seem to be fading now and that are sort of, you know, really want to defeat Cruz.
Yeah, I mean, well, right now some of the most kind of bitter attacks on Cruz or criticism is coming from the camps and the allies of those two past caucus winners, Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum. I mean, they both have made clear in this kind of home stretch to Iowa that they view Cruz as a kind of a phony conservative or someone who is just out for himself. These are obviously two lower polling candidates, but they're very familiar with the political landscape in Iowa. And they think particularly that among social conservatives, Cruz has kind of has fooled them in some ways. They've kind of raised questions, and other candidates have, about the authenticity of, Cruz's faith, for example. And, all of this is kind of pointing to an even bitter finish, I think, in the next few weeks before the February 1st caucuses.
Coming from Texas, that just seems ridiculous, the idea of someone questioning his faith and his conservative credentials. What's the reception when people are hearing those arguments out in Iowa?
Well, I mean, you hear people question him about attack ads every now and then, hey, I heard this on the radio, I heard this on TV, can you just explain a little more? It doesn't seem like so far a lot of these attacks on Cruz as a, inconsistent conservative have been all that effective. I think the best exhibit of that is the fact that, Marco Rubio's campaign has been aggressively working for more than a month now to try to undercut Cruz on a variety of issues and really portray him broadly as, someone, who speaks out of both sides of his mouth, is politically advantageous. And I just don't think those attacks have caught on in Iowa and certainly in other early voting states. Now, those attacks from the Rubio camp and other camps have certainly put Cruz on the defensive more so than he's been throughout this whole race. He's had a few kind of messy interviews where he's gotten a little testy. But as far as, really hurting him with his core group of supporters, I don't think they've made a lot of progress. The Cruz supporters are kind of like the Trump supporters in that anytime there's an attack on their guy, they kind of just categorically tune it out. Even if there is, maybe a hint of truth to it or some credibility to it, there is that kind of tribal mentality that, this is just the establishment going after Cruz. They've had it out for him for forever. We're not going to put any stock in this. And so when you look at the Cruz and Trump supporters, I think they kind of share that in common.
Yeah, and I don't see how politically advantageous is a knock against somebody when you're talking about an Iowa caucus where Carly Fiorina, a Stanford graduate, said, "You know what? Go Iowa Hawkeyes!" There in the bowl game, it just seems like that's what you do when you're trying to win Iowa.
Yeah, exactly. It is an argument that you can imagine people would make. I mean, Cruz is very ambitious. He's been ambitious, in politics for a long time. He's very self-assured. He's perhaps one of the most kind of outwardly cocky candidates in the race. And so I think, some of his rivals have latched onto that attitude and tried to kind of expand it to he's also, just willing to say whatever to get elected. I don't know if a lot of his supporters are really willing to cross that bridge. So we'll see how it shakes out.
Patrick, he hasn't spent near as much time in New Hampshire as he has in Iowa. Mm-hmm. Is he riding off New Hampshire? Is there any hope that he can? I want to say in third place there. It's like Trump, Trump, Rubio, Cruz. What's going on in New Hampshire for Ted Cruz?
I think for a period in late November, early December, there was some uncertainty about how exactly his campaign was approaching New Hampshire. I think you're going to see a late push from them in New Hampshire. He's scheduled to be back in the state on January 12th, which would be his first trip there since he filed to get on the ballot there back in November. So it'll be going on 2 months. And, you would certainly forgive people for thinking that maybe he's writing off the state. Certainly when you compare the amount of trips he's made to New Hampshire with the amount of trips he's made to Iowa, which is, in Iowa, he's kept a very intensive campaign schedule. But he's going to be back in New Hampshire January 12th. He's going to be back again later this month for a bus tour, I believe, of all the counties in the state. And he's also opening up a volunteer residence in New Hampshire, similar to the one that he has in Iowa. As we're speaking right now, today, Tuesday, he's launching his first major TV ad there. And so I think, you know, the campaign is gradually making clear that they certainly see an opening there, and they're definitely not writing it off. One thing that benefits them in New Hampshire is you do have a very jumbled kind of establishment lane. You have people like John Kasich, Chris Christie, Jeb Bush, and to an extent Marco Rubio, all kind of competing in that establishment lane, splintering that kind of more moderate GOP support. And that does provide an opening for a more conservative candidate like Cruz to kind of consolidate support in the other lanes and have a surprisingly strong showing in New Hampshire if he can accomplish that.
They always say in Iowa, and I guess the same thing in New Hampshire, that, you know, somebody needs to actually, a voter needs to actually shake the candidate's hand before they can decide whether or not to vote for him. Ted Cruz is a great speaker. I think he himself has said he's not the guy that he doesn't want to go get a beer with you. So how is that working out? How are people responding to him, you know, after the speech when he's mingling, or does he mingle?
Yeah. He does, Most of these events, you know, regardless of the format, even if it's a quick stop by, he does mingle for at least half an hour after delivering remarks. And I think that he has improved on that front. I remember traveling with him to Iowa back in May or June of 2015, and he was, you know, a little stiff in even smaller group settings. And, he obviously has this very theatrical style when speaking, which plays very well when he's delivering a speech. Back then, it didn't play very well when he was, you know, dealing one-on-one. But I think he's been able to cultivate his own kind of retail politicking style. And you've really seen it on display, obviously, in these past few trips to Iowa, where his campaign has scheduled these events where he, literally pops up in small towns, goes into jam-packed gas stations and convenience stores, and is pretty much forced to be personable and forced to be, shaking hands and, talking to people one-on-one. I mean, I think the way these events have been planned, they've been almost about candidate improvement as they have been about showing off the candidates. This campaign has really forced them to go into settings where you just can't avoid having good retail politics skills. And again, I think we've seen some improvement on that front.
Cruz is now in first place in a lot of the polls in Iowa. How does the campaign see his path right now? I mean, obviously they hope for a win on caucus night, not as sure about what will happen in New Hampshire. But what's kind of the path to victory that they're talking about right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think their ideal path right now is a win in Iowa, and then ride that momentum into New Hampshire and just beat expectations in New Hampshire. Again, no one is under any assumption that, you know, Cruz is going to win New Hampshire or even come in second there. But I think that, you know, what they're playing in New Hampshire is an expectations game. And I think you'll see that it won't be too hard for them to beat expectations, at least national expectations, if he does win Iowa and heads into New Hampshire with that momentum. And then they have a real possibility in South Carolina, I think, of consolidating that momentum from winning Iowa, performing better than expected New Hampshire, and then maybe really having a showdown with Trump in South Carolina, if you do believe where polls currently are in South Carolina. You know, then obviously Lana in Nevada could have the top three finish there. And then they've got the Super Tuesday states, the SEC primary states, which include Texas on March 1st. They believe that, you know, he could be the real winner that day. It's not just Texas. It's all these southern states that are deeply religious, deeply conservative, you know, and they think that could really be a firewall. You know, he's recently started raising the specter of this whole primary being over in 90 days. And so I think that when you start looking at the ideal path for him, that, you know, if that does play out the way he'd like it to play out, there is some truth to that. But that's kind of been a new line that he's had. He's been telling supporters that this whole thing could be wrapped up in 90 days.
I guess just actually one final question. Is it true that you eat Pizza Ranch every day?
I've been to many Pizza Ranches, but I've never had a slice. So I guess that's kind of on my to-do list.
All right, Patrick Svitek, reporter for the Texas Tribune. He's on the road right now in Iowa with Ted Cruz. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A couple of quick notes before we go. First up, we've got another live show and debate watching party planned for The Ticket. Join me and Jay February 11th on the UT Austin campus for a live taping, followed by the Democratic debate from Wisconsin.
Doors open at 5:30 p.m. and the live recording will begin promptly at 6 p.m. The debate should begin at 7 p.m., but final times haven't been set. We'll make sure to update the times here and on Twitter as soon as we know what's happening.
The event will be held in the Belo building at UT. We'll be on the second floor in the auditorium there. It's free, but you really do need to RSVP to claim a ticket. Just go to texastribune.org and click on the events page. We'd love to have you join us. And one more plug, please help us share this podcast with the rest of the world by visiting earbud.fm. That's the new NPR curated webpage that helps people discover great podcasts. If you'd like to help promote this podcast, go to the site and click on the Send Us a Podcast button to suggest a show.
You can follow The Ticket on Twitter at TheTicket2016. You can reach us on email, theticket2016@gmail.com. You can also find all of our episodes at our website, theticket2016.com. While on the website, we've got links to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. So be sure to sign up.
The Ticket is a co-production of KUT News and the Texas Tribune. KUT Managing Editor Matt Largie helps keep us in line. And our theme music is by Ben Root. Thanks for listening.